Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fama Conversations, episode 6. I continue to be Jeremy Parrish, and I continue to talk about old video games in the chronological order of their release, which, of course, is a tie-in to the VideoWorks video series on YouTube and the books that are published with the same content in print. They're like old-school NFTs, except everyone can own them. And this is the podcast form. So my goal with Fama Conversations continues to be to bring insights and, you know, just information about these games that didn't necessarily fit into the videos, since those are fairly structured in terms of script and podcasts. Generally, this podcast certainly is not structured like that and is much more free form. So last episode and the episode before that, I guess, we talked about, I talked about the SG-1000's launch lineup, the first three games to ship. There were actually, I think, more games than that that actually came out on day one, but Sega hasn't actually chronicled that information. So I'm just kind of going in terms of numbers. Last episode, I brought in a Mahjong expert to talk about the fourth game on the SG-1000 release list, which was excitingly called Mahjong, and the subsequent Mahjong releases on SG-1000 and Famicom for 1983-84. And so from here on, we're jumping back into the SG-1000 proper, since we've talked about Famicom games from 1983. There's a lot more games for SG-1000 in 1983 than there were for Famicom, and we're going to discuss them all. In this case, this episode, we consists of myself and a VideoWorks patron who has frequently commented on SG-1000, and therefore I thought this would be an amazing person to have on the show. So please introduce yourself and like what's the deal with you and SG-1000?
I'm Branwyn Shoup, retired songwriter, professionally about. I have sort of like some video stuff I work on, but it's more like the late night public access version of retro gaming YouTube. So it's, I feel like professionalism is out the window as a rule there. But once upon a time, I thought, I wonder if there are any other Golgo 13 games out there. And it turns out the first one's on the SG. And it blew my mind that there was a Sega console that seemed so unknown for a company of their stature. And yeah, and I've been, when I was a toddler, we had a ColecoVision, then we had a Commodore 128, eventually got an NES. Like I've been around. I'm a pretty well learned chick, but it just blew my mind that there was something out there that before the Master System that nobody seems to know about. And around that time, the Mega SG came out, so I got those adapters and started hunting down the games.
Yeah, it seems like even Sega doesn't really know about the SG-1000. You know, they do occasionally. I feel like every once in a while, their social account will mention it, like, "Hey, there was a thing that happened." But in terms of reissues, anything like that, it just doesn't happen. It's just like, here is something that has been swept away into the missing corners of history, and I can say from personal experience, watching my YouTube stats drop pretty dramatically, and my new subscriptions like drop by 75% to 80% since I started covering SG-1000. There's not a lot of interest in the platform out there, but to me that makes it even more important to, you know, to properly chronicle and to say, hey, this was out there. And as I get into 1985's releases in VideoWorks, we're going to see a lot of games that have direct hooks to the Master System library. And, you know, how the Mark III and Master System evolved out of that sort of card era. But yeah, my this whole venture for me started because of the Mega SG, also the analog Mega SG, because I got the adapters mostly just, you know, like to have that utility in case I ever decided this is a thing I want to play, or, you know, in case the need ever came up. So I decided to buy a few of the SG-1000 My Card games. And I really fell in love with that particular format. The not just the cards themselves. I mean, having, you know, complete video games on something the size of a credit card, as any NEC TurboGrafx fan knows is pretty rad. But also the packaging, just like the way the boxes are these neat little self-contained cardboard, like very, very compact, slim cardboard trays that open up, and they've got like a plastic tray mounted inside, and the manual's in there and the card. It's just very compact, very well designed. And so I just kept buying them. And then I realized, like, you know, I really ought to cover these because people want me to cover Master System. And I feel like because these platforms are kind of the same thing. I mean, the SG-1000 is kind of the Master System. Just, you know, the Master System had a better video processor, but inside it ran on the same CPU. So yeah, that actually made me say, what the hell, I'll go for it. And yeah. So here we are, shedding traffic, shedding subscribers, but in the end, nah. We'll have a richer understanding of Sega. And isn't that what it's all ultimately all about?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so picking up from the SG-1000 catalog numbering, Borderline, Safari Hunting, InSub, and Mahjong were games numbered G01 through G04. G05 is Champion Golf. Now, I don't know if these games, like the catalog number actually indicates anything realistically in terms of how these games were actually released and, you know, the order in which they hit the market. I'm guessing not, because two of the games, Golgo 13 and Orgus, that would seemingly fall, you know, in terms of catalog number into the 1983 releases, Sega says, oh no, those didn't ship till 84. So I've decided not to get too fussed about it. So Champion Golf is next in the catalog number. And, you know, it kind of defines what the SG-1000 is all about for me. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that. Champion Golf?
I can see that, because, I mean, I feel like everyone got so attached to the control scheme in NES Golf, and this is like almost there, but not quite. It's that sort of half measure to it. Not much of a golf person in particular, but it has its charms, I guess.
Yeah, I don't have any desire to go out onto the actual links and hit balls 100, you know, 300 feet, meters, whatever it is, to a hole far, far away. My vision's not that good. And, you know, miniature golf is okay sometimes, but I do enjoy a good golf video game, especially like T&E soft games. They're just well done and they're very satisfying.
You know, that's true. T&E soft did the Virtual Boy one, right?
Mm-hmm.
I actually played that a lot for a Virtual Boy game, which was unusual. I forgot about that one.
Yeah, they just have a knack for it. And they do use a system based very much on the scheme, like the mechanics that Nintendo came up with for golf on NES. Hmm. But Champion Golf predates that. Golf on NES shipped in early 1984 in Japan, like May of 84. Champion Golf maybe was up to like 9-10 months before that. So this really feels like a piece of, you know, a previous generation. Like there's a kind of, I think a viewpoint or a belief that the SG-1000 and Famicom, despite releasing on the same day, were kind of different generations of console hardware. And I think games like this do kind of, you know, promote that belief, whether it's fair or not.
Yeah. It, golly, the sort of, there's a charm to the sort of like the assistant around the perimeter of the screen. It sort of turns it into something where you're sort of taken out of the box. It's very unusual in terms of like realism or lack there of.
Yeah, so I think most people know golf games because of, you know, post NES golf takes on the genre, which all kind of, you know, mostly work the same way, where you have kind of your golfer and you have the hole in the distance and the little flag sticking out of it. And then you choose your club and you kind of determine your direction. You look at which way the wind is blowing and then, you know, choose like the power and possibly the spin of your shot. And it all uses meters that kind of slide back and forth, and you have to hit it with the proper timing. It depends on the game, but it all kind of works about the same. This is not like this. This is much more in line with like an Atari 2600 take on golf, where, yeah, you mentioned the perimeter. So you basically always have a top-down view of the course, and you kind of move your golfer, or maybe it's supposed to be your caddy, I don't know, around
caddy, that's the word I was looking for. Golly.
Yeah, you move your caddy around the perimeter of the screen, which is a very clumsy system. Like if you press the opposite direction of the edge of the screen you're on, you'll jump to the other side, which is kind of handy. But then when you get to corners, it's really like I always get kind of bogged down. So it's a little awkward, but basically you still choose your club. And then you, I guess, choose your power to a degree, but it's not with the same elegant meter system. But your caddy is kind of like your reticle. And so instead of like, you know, aiming on the course, you're aiming around the perimeter of the course based on where your caddy is standing. It feels very, just awkward, I guess, is the best way to describe it.
This sounds odd, but there's sort of like a weird budget Commodore feel to that, I think. It's not ideal. just the idea of, you know, your caddy would not be that far outside the bounds. It's goofy. And the controls around the edges, it almost reminds me of Taito's Zookeeper.
Interesting. Yeah, the way the caddy works, basically they're like running around the edge of the golf course. And I guess the idea is they're like standing over here saying like, hey, aim at me.
Yeah.
Aim at me. And, you know, the goal is to get the hole between your golfer and the caddy who's running around the edge of the screen. But it is funny you should mention, or maybe appropriate that you should mention, a budget C64 feeling, because this did start out as a PC game. This was developed by a company called Logitech. Not that Logitech, not the one that makes headphones, a different one.
Without the H, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm not super familiar with them, to be honest.
It doesn't seem like they made a lot of games.
I would assume that their resume isn't quite as long as a result of maybe not quite pulling this off.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is early days of the video games industry. You know, a lot of times a game developer, a game studio was just like one person, like, you know, like they taught themselves how to program in BASIC or something and said, you know, I'm going to sell a game. And, you know, they'd get picked up through magazines or just like solicitations from publishers or whatever. And, you know, a game would come out. That would be it. That person would say, you know, this wasn't it for like, this isn't my thing. This isn't my career choice. So I don't really know what the story is behind Logitech, not that Logitech. It's, you know, they made this game for, I believe, the MSX home computer console hybrid, which also shipped around the same time as the SG-1000. And then that was adapted into this SG-1000 version, I think, by Sega. Looking up, you know, there's not a lot of firm info about this. GDRI, the Game Developer Research Institute, is probably the best source of info for anything SG-1000 related, because they seemed, you know, they came out of, they emerged from the website SMS, Sega Master System Power. Yeah. So they care a lot about esoterica around Sega platforms. But even, you know, for something like this, there's just not a lot of info. But it does seem to be the case that this was an MSX home computer release, which, you know, has a very similar architecture to the SG-1000. So it makes sense that Sega would look to the MSX and say, let's do that one.
I wish there had been more leaps laterally from the MSX to the SG-1000, to be honest. It's definitely lacking in RPG adjacent things, let's say, because I don't know how well the SG could handle a massive RPG.
You know, there are a couple of RPG. Well, I guess there's one RPG on the SG-1000, the Black Onyx.
Black Onyx, yeah,
which isn't that massive, but it's out there. You know, they made the effort. And there's also a couple of SG-1000 gold cartridges, which kind of straddle the line between Master System and SG-1000. And I haven't played those yet, but it seems like they might be kind of in the RPG adventure-ish vein. There's like Meitante Holmes, I think, like a Sherlock Holmes game.
Yeah, and I think the castle, I think, falls in between that. And...
yeah, the castle, I think, is... isn't that the same thing as Castellian? Like I said, I haven't gotten there yet, so I actually don't know. But it's like a platformer with the rotating center. That is my thought. I could be wrong.
It's actually the sequel is Castle Quest on the NES. It's that sort of large grid of castle rooms that you have to... it's a lot more puzzly than action-y, but you have to measure your leaps and go around flames and dodge the enemies and pick up keys to go through certain doors.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, I'm looking at a screenshot now. And yeah, this is very much in the sort of like mid-80s PC action adventure type single screen room game. You know, kind of almost like a prototype Metroidvania, but not quite.
That one actually has a couple of different ports too, so they must have thought enough of it to take it elsewhere.
Oh, yeah, there's even a map that someone drew on GameFAQs. And yeah, that does have that kind of, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood between like Jet Set Willy and Spelunker.
Yeah, I do kind of prefer the SG one because the NES one sort of overcooks things. And the castle for the SG, you know, you jump and then the other button, strangely enough, speeds up and slows down play, which is odd as a
that is strange
main button feature, but...
anyway, that's the castle, which is a long ways away.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. It's fine. I am still learning about this platform, so I enjoy the opportunity. But yeah, I guess there's not much more to say about Champion Golf. But what I said at the beginning about how it kind of talks about, or like kind of demonstrates what the SG-1000 is all about, what I really meant by that was, you know, it is a system that architecturally lacked the power and kind of forward thinking nature of the Famicom. And there were a lot of innovations that happened, especially in like sports genres in 1984. And, you know, a lot of the early releases for SG-1000 were still kind of made in that mindset of like how games have been, so much as like how games should be. But as you move into 1984, you do start to see the developers, you know, take better advantage of the hardware. And even though the hardware is, you know, fundamentally unchanged, the games just become richer and more complex and they pull off more interesting things. But these early days, it's definitely like, you know, arcade ports from 1981, you know, it just feels kind of simple and fairly primitive.
And I think in Champion Golf's defense, it got reprinted two or three times. It got the sort of smaller box art of the cartridge version, and then there's two different MyCard versions, packaging-wise. So they must have thought enough of it, unless it's sort of about that sort of Japanese love of things like golf and baseball that just sort of automatically made it worth keeping around. I'm not sure.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, this also did see release in multiple, what do you call it, multiple regions, Australia, Europe. So it definitely made its way around. And I, you know, this was pretty much as good as golf games got at the time. It's just that the following year, the world would basically say, oh, wow, golf can be so much better than this, as both, you know, NES Golf and even to a degree, Aya Okamoto's Match Play Golf on the Othello Multivision shipped. And that's like the one notable game, I think, that ever came to Multivision, like the one time it ever did anything meaningful. Anyway, that's Champion Golf. Next up is Serizawa Hachidan no Tsume Shogi, which basically means the eighth level master Serizawa's shogi training, shogi teaching, basically, a shogi lesson, I guess. So Serizawa, and the title is Hirobumi Serizawa, a kind of champion shogi player. And, you know, shogi, if you're not familiar with it, I'm sure you're familiar with it, but, you know, for anyone who's not familiar with it, is a chess-like game that uses usually wooden pieces or similar tiles, each imprinted with a different Japanese kanji text character that represents basically, you know, Japanese equivalents of chess pieces. So instead of having different shapes to the pieces, it's just different characters, which is much harder to kind of parse if you don't know kanji. And even if you do, like, these are, you know, in a game like this, they're upside down, half of them. So it's tricky. But I mean, the fact that they went to the trouble, the first endorsed game, the first like celebrity likeness they locked down for SG-1000 is a top level, like the equivalent of a top level chess player. You know, this is not a game aimed for kids, for sure.
And it's kind of a shame that the Serizawa didn't even make it to the box art, which is kind of odd.
Yeah, in future shogi releases endorsed by champions, especially on like Famicom, you get photographs or illustrations. There's one that I recently touched on, posting the box art to Instagram, where it's like the box art is basically a Polaroid of the champion chess player that it features sitting in front of like a restaurant wall or something. It's like there's bad flash on the camera and it leaves shadows behind him. It's just like, wow, this is a product that you put on the market and you literally just like snapped a Polaroid and were like, this is it. This is the box art. I will say, at least, you know, the box art they came up with for Sumi Shogi on SG-1000 is actually kind of exciting. It's like, it's about as dynamic as you get with, you know, these kind of square-ish tiles written, you know, marked with kanji.
I often wonder, I feel like Nintendo especially could have made more of an effort in getting things like Shogi and Mahjong. I mean, I don't think they would have caught fire in America, especially amongst kids. But it seems like in a couple of different instances, games like this are the one they leave out of the launch titles. Like Yakuman for the Game Boy and the Shogi for the N64 was the third of the only three launch titles here in Japan.
Yeah, I think there's just this kind of cultural gap here where maybe it's not so much of a case now that, you know, people who publish things and sell products realize that, hey, America is a country made up of people from many different backgrounds. And there are a lot of people of Asian descent here who play things like Shogi and Mahjong. But in the 80s, it was like, the white kids won't know what this is. Let's not sell this to them. And, you know, it is fairly esoteric here. And I think that's slowly changing. But even so, I think this would have been a really, you know, if the SG-1000 had shipped here, this would have been a hard sell. But you know, in Japan, like, this kind of game was actually a huge selling point for consoles and computers. You know, like, they featured Mahjong games really, really heavily in early television advertisements for Famicom and SG-1000. Like, there's a Famicom commercial, I think it might have been the first Famicom commercial to air. It basically leads with Mahjong. Like, that's the glamour title. It's not Donkey Kong. It's not the upcoming Mario Brothers, a port of an arcade game that was just released like 2 months prior. It is Mahjong. It's, hey, you can play Mahjong at home on the computer, on your television. That's amazing. It's only $200 to play Mahjong anytime you want. That was a huge selling point. It's just kind of hard to sort of envision that now, but that was definitely the case.
I'm not 100% certain, but I believe Mahjong was the first million seller for the Famicom.
I mean, that wouldn't surprise me. Like, who was buying consoles in 1983? It wasn't kids. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that was a little outside the average, what do you call it? Not salary, allowance.
Yeah.
you know, speaking for myself, like when my brother and I bought an NES, we both saved up quite a bit for it and, you know, quite a while. And every game we bought, you know, we had to put back money and really take the time to earn up enough money to be able to buy those games. It was hard fought every single time. But, you know, parents or just adults, that was a pretty easy sell to them. Like, hey, here's something that you enjoy doing, and now you can do it with computer assistance, you know, in the comfort of your own home anytime you want on the television you already own. That was pretty compelling.
I think the SG-1000 Sumi Shogi also sort of has like an arm's length mentality to it, because it's a series of preset puzzles that you have to solve. Mm-hmm. And I think something like, you know, nowadays they have Clubhouse games for the Switch, and like finally people will get a chance to actually maybe learn Mahjong and Shogi and Hanafuda. But in this case, you have to know how to play the game, and then you have to like adapt that to like preset moves and things that are like laid out for you. And that certainly, there would be no way in hell this would be in America.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a missed opportunity here, because I think, you know, if they had presented this as like a proper tutorial game, then it could have had some value, I think, for, you know, for Western players. But I don't think there was enough memory space in a game like this to, you know, for on the ROM to actually give proper lessons. So instead, it just kind of dumps you in. Mm-hmm. There is no standard way to play standard shogi in this game. You can play the specific lessons, the object lessons that have been programmed in, which are like, hey, you've got two pieces. The enemy, you know, the opponent has four pieces, but you have these specific pieces in this specific placement. So can you, you know, take out all the opponent's pieces in X number of moves? Mm-hmm. You know, it like you said, it really does presume an understanding of how shogi works. And yeah, like I kind of get what they were going for here. And I think they probably went with this sume shogi style over like a standard shogi match, because I don't know if the SG-1000 actually could have handled a proper shogi game, like, you know, with full AI and everything.
Yeah,
you look at other systems that came along later, and they struggle, you know, more powerful systems to play shogi matches.
I was gonna say, I feel like they probably weren't confident in their ability to have a proper AI. Granted, they have it in two different Mahjong games, but I think this sort of points to its complexity a little bit more.
Yeah, Mahjong has some weird rules, and I've described it as like the Calvin ball of tabletop games, where it's just like, I think I get it. Oh, no, I don't get it.
Oh, that's perfect.
But yeah, shogi is maybe more complicated than chess. And it's one of those things where it has a lot of complexity, to the point that, you know, I think I've mentioned this in videos before, but Seta, who made a lot of shogi games on Super Famicom, they ended up selling a shogi game just in Japan, of course, that had basically like a precursor to the Game Boy Advance processor in the cartridge. It was a full like ARM 3 processor running many, many times faster than the Super NES itself. Like, I don't know, like 20 times, 30 times faster. It was some ridiculous number. It was a super expensive cartridge, but that's what it took to get a proper shogi AI, you know, calculating fast enough for the game to be playable and not a miserable experience and still challenging on the Super NES, which is a way more powerful system than the SG-1000. So yeah, this is them definitely trying to like hit, you know, kind of check a box, but not really having the means to check that box the way it probably should have been with a full game.
A bit more like not paying attention to the paper, looking somewhere else and checking outside the box slightly or something.
I don't know. I think I would describe the next game on the list as that's Congo Bongo.
I think the most damning thing about the SG-1000, I feel bad that I'm talking like so much trash about these games when I'm supposed to be defending my underdog to some extent.
I mean, the SG-1000 had a rough start. It's fair to say. Like the really great stuff, that was, you know, late 84, 85, that's when things got really good. Yeah. Like there is some fantastic stuff ahead. But yeah, the start was very shaky.
I think the most damning thing, though, is when they made the collection of earlier games for the Sega Ages series on the PS2. They had a whole bunch of SG-1000 games, but the Congo Bongo one, they just substituted the arcade version.
Yeah, and why wouldn't you? Because that was it was a really cool looking game in arcades. It was very impressive. It was like Sega's answer literally to Donkey Kong. And it was way more sophisticated looking. I don't know if it was more fun to play, but it looked so cool. Yeah. Like that is a game that, you know, I would see computer ports of it on demo at a you know, computer shop in like 1983, 84 when I was a kid. And I would just look at it and be like, man, I want to play that. It's so rad. And I was looking forward to owning and playing and making a video retrospective about Congo Bongo for this series. Yeah. And then I played it and it was heartbreaking. Just so sad. So terrible.
I can't even imagine how it came about that way. It's because almost every other home computer port is normal. It's just so bizarre that they would remove the isometric graphics, which is honestly, I mean, not a huge... It's one of the selling points. I think that sort of adjacent nature to Donkey Kong is probably one of the things that lured people in a lot. But the only contemporary review I could find was a magazine from New Zealand reviewing it as an SC-3000 title. And it was a little better than lukewarm. But then again, I don't believe they had Congo Bongo in the arcades there.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, if you haven't played Congo Bongo, the real thing, you might say, oh, this is okay. Mm. But if you know anything about the game, then yeah, it's inexplicably terrible. This was Sega's own game. It was an arcade flagship title. It should have been a flagship title on SG-1000. Like when they brought it home, they should have poured their all into it and just made a kick-ass version to annihilate every other conversion of the game out there. And that's the opposite of what they did. They took away the cool isometric perspective where you are basically doing the Donkey Kong thing, but it with a sort of forced 3D viewpoint. And it's more like a top-down 2D forced three-quarters perspective. Kind of like if you tried to play Donkey Kong in the Zelda engine.
Yeah. It reminds me of that, that first stage in Borderline, where you can't really tell what the perspective is because things are falling on you, like they're affected by gravity, but you're still like passing through things laterally in a way that makes that seem awkward.
Yeah, and you know that that design actually made more sense with Borderline. After I made the video, I discovered that the game had been converted into a space shooter called Star Raker, I think it was, where you are actually like flying upward through a trench and things are actually falling at you. I was like, oh, okay, now I get it. That is logical. But yeah, it doesn't make sense necessarily in Borderline. Still a fun game. But here it's really rough, especially when you get to the second stage and you have to make these jumps over snakes that are patrolling a platform and then onto hippos to cross water and reach where Congo Bongo is, because it's really hard to judge the actual relationship between your character and the dangerous things and the beneficial things. And so, like, you know, I played this game several times through trying to get a handle on that second stage, and I just couldn't. And I eventually just got frustrated and stopped and said, you know what, I can write a review based on this. Yeah. But then it turns out it's okay, because another thing this version of Congo Bongo doesn't have are two of the four stages from the arcade game. It's just the first and I think third stage from the arcade game. The second and fourth stages just nowhere to be found.
Yeah, that's I feel like maybe they thought since there's one missing from Donkey Kong, maybe they can get away with chopping something like that, but maybe not half of them.
That's well, Nintendo has this arcade perfect version of Donkey Kong, almost arcade perfect. Like it looks great. It drops the intermissions and it drops the cement factory, but otherwise it's pretty much the arcade game. So why don't we take our game that looks nothing like the arcade game and is not fun or good and get rid of half the content?
Yeah.
The fans will thank us because they don't have to play as much of this bad game.
We already kneecapped it once. Let's go for the other knee.
Yeah, it's a huge disappointment. Like if I were a kid who had bought the SG-1000 looking forward to the cool arcade Donkey Kong Killer Congo Bongo, I would have been filled with tremendous remorse for buying this system. Fortunately, Congo Bongo ran on the same hardware in arcades as Zaxxon, and Zaxxon, they wouldn't release Zaxxon until 1985, and it was good of them to sit on it and wait until they could actually do that game justice, because Zaxxon on SG-1000 is good and it is a convincing facsimile of the arcade game. So the system could have done it. There's no reason Congo Bongo couldn't have been arcade accurate or, you know, something close to it on SG-1000. They just didn't. I don't understand. It's terrible and I hate it.
Same. You summed it up better than I could have. It's just such an aberration.
Alas. A bit better. Not quite arcade accurate, but closer and at least somewhat satisfying as a game is Yamato, which takes that Japanese fascination with relitigating World War II and, you know, basically saying, yeah, we're doomed. You've got 1943, 1942 by Capcom, and you have Yamato, where you control the legendary battleship, which, you know, basically the only time in World War II it was really called into action was to kind of hold the line in a doomed, destined to fail battle, which has become romanticized, and, you know, like it that makes it a kind of like a legendary, you know, remember the Alamo kind of thing.
Yeah, I was just about to say that.
But, you know, in terms of video games, it means at some point you are going to lose because that's canon.
Yeah. Yamato, I feel like it's got that sort of pat your head, rub your stomach sort of coordination thing that I can't quite get right because of the aiming situation.
Yeah. Well, first, I don't know that the SG-1000 necessarily needed another military shooter so quickly after Borderline and InSub, but here we are. So, you know, at this point, half the library is military shooters. But yeah, it's a very kind of unusual game where you basically are on the conning tower of the battleship. So you're looking forward over the deck, you know, down the length of the deck and the guns, and, you know, sort of a first person perspective, you're shooting into the horizon as you surprisingly quickly for a battleship of that size spin around and rotate left and right, or sorry, port and starboard, to take aim at encroaching threats. But then, as you mentioned, there is the, you know, pat your head and chew bubblegum thing where you have two different kinds of guns that you're firing with a single reticle.
In a way, you could almost consider it like a great grandparent of Virtual Boy Waterworld or something. I don't know.
Well, okay. I don't know about that.
I know. I think Yamato and NSUB like combined into one thing would have made for a compelling game, switching back and forth between the two stages.
Yeah, that's true. I found NSUB was surprisingly kind of frictionless, considering it's a Sega arcade conversion. Usually Sega games, like, you know, they're arcade games and arcade conversions. You pick those up and you're like completely spanked within 2 minutes. You're just like, whoa, what just happened? I thought I was good at video games, but Sega just told me I'm not. But in sub, you can go for like 10 minutes on a single credit. It's surprisingly easy. So I could see combining, like alternating modes between this game and that game. So you're like side view some of the times, and then first person perspective on the surface of the water the other times. That could be kind of cool.
I think there was a point where there's that point in the mid 90s where people were started looking back on retro things a bit more, and you had like the arcade classic series on the Game Boy, and then eventually the Almighty Namco Museum and the Arcade's Greatest Hits series. I feel like not compiling Yamato and NSUB and Borderline for some sort of budget release or something was a missed opportunity, because I know there was the PlayStation 2 Sega Ages thing, but that was still a ways away. And I think that it was a missed opportunity to show folks what Sega was capable of early on, too.
Yeah, Sega. I conducted an interview with someone working with one of Sega's partners for the Limited Run Games newsletter, tying into the the Sega Astro City Mini that we published, or at least distributed in the US. And, this is in the newsletter, I think, that's already been distributed, so I'm not spoiling any surprises here. But the perception I got just based on that interview is that Sega kind of begins calculating its history with Space Harrier and OutRun and the advent of Yu Suzuki's superscalar type games. That's not like a hard and fast rule, but you really don't see Sega going back to things before that very often.
I think, maybe one of those reasons is because in the early 80s, there's a whole lot of corporate chess going on with Sega.
That is true. Do you want to talk about that a little?
Oh, golly. I
not to put you on the spot. That's okay. It's complicated.
I know. They were owned by Gulf and Western at the time and ended up with CSK, who also ended up with their own label, and sort of not in like a Konami Ultra sense, but I know Speedball 2 came out through CSK on the Genesis, which is odd. But there's so many different like Sega Enterprises, Sega Entertainment and Limiteds and Incorporateds. I would definitely get it wrong if I tried to be a little more detailed about that. And I think the founder of Gulf and Western might have died, and that's when they sort of gave up. I'm not sure.
I believe so. I hope I'm not conflating that with Coleco. No, I think you're right. I think the founder of Gulf and Western passed, and the company was already kind of like looking at dividing up its assets and selling some stuff off, and that I think kind of hastened the demise of things like the hardware, or, the arcade division, the games entertainment division. I'm sure the US market crash also didn't hurt their desire to get rid of that, just like cut off the dying limbs.
That, I mean, there's a sort of concurrent governmental, well, not maybe crackdown isn't the word, but there was that sort of governmental push to keep kids out of arcades in Japan too, which mm-hmm. is definitely what sped up the console market in a way, because I think I believe there were like hints that the Famicom was coming along, and Sega sort of lopped the keyboard off the SC-3000 in a panic. It was probably just too experimental a time to want to look back on.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of formative work from the early 80s and things that would be kind of foundational. And occasionally they'll go back and like, hey, Zaxxon existed.
Yeah.
But in general, yeah, you just don't hear a lot about these games. And yeah, they're dated, but they're still pretty good. Like there's some pretty cool arcade stuff from Sega that I never knew about until I started, working my way through SG-1000 and realizing like, oh, this is based on an arcade game that no one has ever mentioned in my presence online or off before in my life.
And there's some Vic Duel titles, excuse me. There's some Vic Duel titles that have been almost completely obscured that are, you mentioned, I believe, Space
Star Raker.
Star Raker. I almost wanted to say Star Jacker again, but
we'll talk about that soon.
I would absolutely. I'd take a bullet for Monaco GP. I love that game. It's so. I think that was actually still profitable in American arcades in the late 80s.
Yeah, I would. I would really like to see Monaco GP show up as a game, you know, ported to the Mister system.
Yeah.
You know, someone would have to spend a lot of time on that because it's TTL logic as opposed to, you know, like a standard microprocessor setup. But it is a cool racing game, and it was very influential. And like that was kind of the beginning of Sega's entire racing legacy, which is significant. But it does, you know, they don't really bring that game back very often. And when they have revisited it, it's been like the early PS2 Sega Ages games, which were not that good. Mm-hmm. They were like, why don't we take this extremely old game and give it kind of bad modern day graphics? And that's, yeah, not the best. Not really the treatment it deserved.
And the SG one is, I think, perfectly fine. It's, honestly, I think that's, I might have played that on an emulator early on, and that's when I was like, okay, I need to focus on this system. I really want to play this stuff.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so Yamato, it's part of that lost generation of Sega arcade games that you just don't ever hear them talk about it. And, you know, again, it's not like the greatest game in the world, but the arcade version seems interesting. It's got pretty nice graphics for the time, and that kind of dual gun setup is interesting because you've basically got like hit scan weapons and then you've got targeted weapons, and so you kind of have to figure out like where you're aiming, like how am I going to hit the thing, and you have kind of a limited range, you know, angle of fire on the weapons too. So it takes some strategy and, you know, some skill. But again, it does seem a little repetitive coming so soon after InSub, which also does like oceanic combat on multiple levels, gives you two different kinds of weapons, but you're firing forward and upward instead. I don't know. They might have waited a little longer, but I guess they just felt like, hey, we got to get this out ASAP.
Yeah, I'm one of the rare folks that, I don't know if I should admit this, but I'm okay. I'm kind of a little fond with LJN's Jaws and the NES, and that's something that NSUB reminds me of.
Hmm, yeah. I think that's actually perfectly all right to say. I think time has been, I think people have kind of come around on that game, and even though it's not great, they've come to realize, like, you know, it's okay, and they had some interesting ideas here.
Yeah.
All right, so let's see. We can tackle at least one more game. We've got Champion Tennis, which, you know, kind of like Champion Golf, this is going to be a theme with any sports game. This is Champion, just about any sports game. It's okay for its time, but very soon after this game was released, there would be a more kind of definitive take on the sport released on Famicom that would really just kind of, you know, pretty much moot the existence of this one.
Yeah, I think the Master System Tennis game is just hateful. It's I have so much trouble with that one. And I think between the sort of bizarre graphics palette and the fact that it's a little more playable, I think I prefer Champion Tennis to the follow-up.
Yeah, the color palette is something definitely worth talking about. I'm kind of using Sega Retro to refresh my memory on like, developers
right
and stuff.
Too.
Yeah, but they don't actually have the full info on this. There's some info that came out when I was, you know, showing off screenshots of this, working on the videos, and GDRI was like, "Hey, yo, there's some stuff you need to know." So what GDRI pointed out, and apparently looking on Twitter, they've tweeted about this game several times over the past decade. It looks like Champion Tennis is a port or conversion, or maybe just parallel release to a game called Real Tennis for the Sorg M5 home computer, which is extraordinarily esoteric. Like, look that up on eBay. Good luck. And also the MSX. And GDRI has kind of narrowed it down to having probably been developed by Tosei, that famous Ghost studio, based on a blurry screenshot presented at a weird kind of oblique angle on Tosei's 2000 corporate guide, because Tosei doesn't actually take a lot of direct credit for their work. I think in a lot of cases they can't. And so they tend not to be credited. They tend to just make stuff and not publicize it and not, you know, present that information in a forward-facing, public-facing way. But if you go to their offices, I've been told by people who have been there that they have like this meeting room, and basically every game they've developed is in these glass cases, which at this point is probably thousands.
Oh, that's
and so,
so cool.
You can see the games that they've made. You just can't like take photos of it, and they're not going to publicize it. But, you know, if you want to know what Tosei has done and what they have worked on, that information is kind of there on display, I think, you know, kind of for their partners to see, like, oh, you know, here are their bona fides. But they can't, you know, just put out a press release saying, oh, yeah, we worked on all these games, unless that's kind of the terms of their agreements. So, you know, for things like Starfy for Game Boy Advance and DS, like, Nintendo actually let them take co-ownership of it. I think also Super Princess Peach, they were credited on the title screen, but that's very uncommon. So yeah, anyway, Champion Tennis appears to be a Tosei game. That was my point.
I would love to see that glass case situation.
Oh yeah,
a Tosei museum. That would be amazing.
I want to just like breathe the air in that room.
even the crap. I just want to see it all. That would be.
Oh yeah, especially the crap.
Yeah, there must be. I mean, there might be some sort of mysteries that we didn't even. There might be things found there that we didn't realize were them that people have been scratching their heads about for ages.
Oh, I don't doubt it. I mean, there's a lot of things that I've covered, like on Game Boy, where no one is credited for it, and even places like GDRI or the Cutting Room Floor don't have any information on these games because they're so minor or so like who cares that it's just never occurred to anyone, or you know, there's no telltale signs of anyone. But like Gundam games by Bonpresto, like you gotta assume that stuff was Tosei because they did so much work with those Japanese cartoon franchises that you just sort of assume like this was probably Tosei.
Yeah. What other company has the range to do Chubby Cherub and the Game Boy Color Metal Gear Solid?
I would say not a lot. Certainly not my Micronix. So anyway, back to Champion Tennis. Yes, it is a weird looking tennis game. The tennis court, it's wild. Like there's some green, but only in the extreme forecourt and extreme backcourt. Otherwise, it's like this. It's almost like one of those Dutch cookies, you know, the little checkerboard cookies.
Yeah.
Except that instead of being like two tones of brown, it's lemon yellow and toxic salmon. I don't know exactly what color that is, but they're very bright, very, very eye searing. The SG-1000 did not have a good color palette. And this game really just goes for it. It's like, let's make it as barfy as we can.
The Master System certainly made up for that.
In what sense?
The color palette. I think that's one of the things that I love the most about the Master System is they seem to learn their lesson here.
Okay. Yeah. I wasn't sure if you meant the way Master System games or Master System plays this game, because the Master System doesn't have support for the video palette that the SG-1000 possesses. So when you play an SG-1000 game on Master System, it looks even worse. And my first few videos actually looked really terrible because I did not realize that and didn't realize that I had to adjust the palette on the SG-1 or the Mega SG. So That was a lesson learned. But
yeah, it's flip by default. I think it's like, is that the MSX palette too?
I think so, yeah. You know, again, very similar systems, just with a mainly a difference in RAM. So Champion Tennis, you know, this is a sports game, obviously a tennis game, and it plays kind of like a proto version of Nintendo's tennis, in that it's a kind of behind the court perspective. You control your little person running forward and backward on the court, scrambling to hit balls back at your opponent in the backcourt. But what makes this one different and worse is that it doesn't have the sense of perspective seen in NES tennis.
That and the Master System one wasn't much of an improvement. I think perspective might have been a second, or well, I guess, yeah, Tosei issue this time. I don't know if it has something to do with sprites, but I think it could come down to an issue with the SG-1000 being able to render the ball and a shadow at the same time, keep them together.
Well, it's not even that perspective. It's also the fact that the two characters are the same size, even though the character in the forecourt is, you know, 20 meters closer to the camera, quote unquote, than the player in the backcourt. But the player in the backcourt is the same size as the player in the forecourt, meaning they basically are a giant dominating that space. So when you are up against a computer opponent who is in the backcourt, they basically just have full coverage, whereas you have to scramble, ass to make it across the court to get the ball.
That's very true.
Of course, when you're playing in the backcourt, it seems like your range is terrible, and it's one of those games that's just stacked against you no matter what.
Yeah.
So not actually that fun. It's close, but again, this is one of those cases where Nintendo would come along like 6 months later, and they would just get it right. I mean, it's not just that NES Tennis looks better, but it has the perspective issue corrected. You have a shadow under the ball. It just feels better. And yeah, it's just, you know, subtle little tweaks, but it really, like, you look at this versus Famicom Tennis at the beginning of 1984, and it's kind of hard to say, oh yeah, yeah, I want to dump all my money into SG-1000. That seems like the way to go. That's that's the console on the cutting edge. So, you know, things like this, I understand that they wanted to get these games out as, you know, to kind of flesh out their launch lineup. And they had so many games out in 83. It did look very impressive, but, you know, some of them were just a little underbaked.
This one actually made it to France. I'm trying to find one kind thing.
The French do love tennis.
Yeah.
It's okay. You don't have to be kind about every game. I'm not being mean to this game. Just saying, it's just didn't quite work out. Good try, guys. Good game.
My sort of dented optimism coming through sometimes with this.
Well, okay, let's end on Star Jacker, which, you know, is not an amazing game, but it's interesting and does some really weird, kind of cool things. And I guess that's, you know, that counts for something.
I think I mean, I like Star Jacker okay, but I would have loved to see what a sequel would have done. But to improve upon a few of the things this lacks.
I feel like there's a good idea here that isn't quite developed properly. So the weird thing about Star Jacker is that it gets harder the longer you play. That's normal. But the reason it gets more challenging is because you become weaker the longer you play.
But a smaller target.
That's true. So I guess it's not that it's harder. It's just that it's harder to score points, but it's easier to avoid being shot. So the premise is that you have four lives in Star Jacker and you get them all at once. They're right there at the start. It's like they saw the capture command or the capture feature in Galaga and were like, what if we made that the default and then doubled it? So it's a vertical shooter, top down, and you're flying upward, you know, very much a game in the mode of Zevius, because so many of these games back then were. But instead of having like the Galaga thing where you've got two ships side by side, you have four ships flying in a like a daisy chain forward to backward. And they all fly kind of behind your lead ship. You know, it's almost like serpentine the way you move around. And every single ship that you're flying with is also firing. So you are basically this destructive force as you begin the game. Just this wall of bullets bearing down on the bad guys. The thing is, you are a huge target. You take up like the bottom third of the screen. It's really hard to avoid taking damage when you have four ships linked together.
It gets a little disorienting too when you have that juddering scrolling also. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And it does get repetitious also. That's,
I haven't survived long enough in this game for it to become repetitious, so I'll take your word on that.
The bosses are all identical. It's sort of like a... it makes me think of the Clamp Center logo from Gremlins 2, but it's sort of like an open C wrench kind of shape that rotates kind of back and flips sort of back and forth, and you want to hit the core of it, Gradius style. And then your ship gets very large and then flies to your dock, recharges. I believe you get an extra ship back, not all of them. And then you basically do the exact same stage over again.
Yeah, it is. I have, you know, made it past the first stage once or twice. And you're right. The mother ships here are pretty much the Zevius and or Genesis, down to the same basic tactic and to defeat them. And you do get extra lives. Basically, I think if you hit a certain score tally during a stage, when you land, when you come in for the landing, then they give you a bonus life based on that score. So they basically give you another ship back. But is that really a good thing? It just means, you know, you're going to die again. In the arcades, when you died, I believe, when one of your ships was destroyed, you just kept flying. But here, that's it. Like, the game stops and you're sent back to a checkpoint.
Yeah.
And that makes it really hard.
If anything, they should have given you an option to, I don't know, change your firepower or take the extra ship. Put a little strategy into it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, when you get whittled down to just one ship, you're puny. There are no power-ups in this game. There are no, like, upgrades to your weapons. You just have four ships that shoot. And once you've lost three of those ships, you have very little firepower. You have, you know, 25% firepower, but you're so tiny, it's really hard for anything to hit you. It's just, you can't really destroy anything in return, because the choppy scrolling that you mentioned, and also I feel like the collision detection is very particular. Like, yeah, you'll seem to hit things that won't blow up.
Yeah, I just simply agree with that. This is one of the rare ones, I guess, we have a release date for.
Yes, this was a launch game. This was not only is it the one game that Sega has a release date officially listed on their website for, it was actually plastered all over the boxes. Like, this was, you know, if you look at the original SG-1000 game box, the packaging, this is the cartridge that's inserted into the system in that photograph. So I guess they had a lot of hopes for it. Seemingly, I don't know.
It's no Zevius killer.
No, it really isn't. And everyone wanted to kill Zevius, but they didn't. They just didn't pull it off. But, you know, there are some interesting ideas here. And you're right. I would love to see what they could have done with a sequel to this. Like, give you more control. What if you could change your ship configuration? Kind of like...
Terra Cresta.
I was also going to say Mercenary Force on Game Boy, where you this like army of four soldiers fighting through feudal Japan, or was it five? And you could switch configurations on the fly, so your team could adapt to the threats and, you know, bunch up to avoid damage or stretch out into a line if you're taking fire from, you know, one direction. I think, you know, giving you that kind of flexibility, even Gradius has or R-Type with its bits, like, you know, the ability to kind of move those around and change how you configure yourself and how you approach things would have gone a long way. Or like you said, you know, say, hey, I don't want, you know, four lives. I want one life with four times the firepower. That could have been interesting too. Or if there had been a way to, like, you know, absorb a ship into yourself and then spit it back out or something. There's a lot of different ideas I can think of, and, you know, maybe someone should make a Star Jagger 2 and call it something maybe that sounds a little less gross. and, you know, like kind of an unofficial sequel that explores some of those ideas, because I think, you know, I think the principle here is good. Like, you basically have your entire fleet at once, but you have to kind of balance that, you know, about between the firepower it offers, but the threat that it also presents to you.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad that in some instances, Sega sort of learned from the 1983 stuff. I think they were a little shocked at the success at first, and that might be why they really stepped up their game in later years.
Yeah, by all accounts, the SG-1000 actually outperformed Famicom at first, and then, you know, fortune started to reverse in 1984. But even so, Sega has, you know, officially kind of said, like, hey, we didn't expect this system to do this well. Like, if it really outsold our projections and our estimates and our needs, and you know, that's great. So let's continue doing this home console gaming thing. So without SG-1000, would we have had Genesis, Saturn, Dreamcast? Probably not.
Probably not.
I mean, maybe, you know, they probably would have continued to publish on home consoles, but would Sega have been a first party? That is unlikely. They probably would have just been a third party publisher all along, and we would have missed out on a lot of stuff that way.
But we might have gotten Borderline for the Game Boy Arcade Classic series or something.
That's true. If only. If only. All right. So that takes us about halfway through this list of 1983 post-launch games for SG-1000, which is a pretty good amount of progress for this episode. I guess next episode I'll continue. Have I talked about Famicom's post-launch games? Maybe I need to do that next. Okay. So next episode, we'll talk about some Famicom, but then definitely some more SG-1000. We'll try to balance it out, keep things lively and interesting. Yeah. But anyway, thank you for providing your insights and experience to, you know, about these games that so few people in America have played.
I'm glad I got to play them.
yeah, and I appreciate your perspectives and experience. So before we call this an episode, why don't you let everyone know where they can find you and your public access work and whatever else you'd like to promote online.
Basically everywhere, I'm just my name, Branwen Shoup. Bran like raisin, Bran Wen like the first syllable of Wendy, and Shoup like the Salt and Pepper song. I do have like a sort of janky YouTube channel, and I'm working on a project. I'm very in the early stages of collecting and scanning things, but I'm trying to put together like an archive or repository of games designed or programmed by trans folks. And I quickly learned that like my people made some good stuff over the years, and I like tracing sort of the arms of influence through things. And a lot of firsts I'm learning about. So I'm pretty excited about that stuff.
Yeah, that sounds really great. That's not something you've publicly released yet, though, right?
No. To be honest, among other things, I'm like having a hard time coming up with a name or a snappy acronym or something. But.
Okay, well, once you get a name for that, I'd be interested in seeing more about it and, you know, helping to promote it once it's out in the world.
Fantastic.
Anyway, thanks again, Branwen, for your perspectives. I would love to have you back on this little podcast again sometime.
Thanks.
And until then, that's it for this month. Thanks everyone for supporting VideoWorks. If you are listening to this episode in the year of our Lord 2021, that means you are a supporter of VideoWorks, and I would not be able to handle this series. I would not be able to tackle this series, and certainly not in the level of quality that I'm able to without everyone's financial support. So thank you, as always, for making this archiving and history documentary, etc. series possible. If you are not listening in the year 2021. You may still be a supporter, in which case, thanks, but maybe you're listening to this on a public feed, in which case, hey, good news. You can find out more about these games and many others, especially lots of NES games, Game Boy games, on my YouTube channel, Jeremy Parrish. There's only one R in Parrish. Don't let them lie to you. Yeah, you can check that out on YouTube, and you can support the show on Patreon, patreon.com/gamespite. That's GameSpite. And that's pretty much it. So that'll wrap for this month, and I'll be back in a month with more talk about old video games, this time from the Nintendo side of things.